Technology has certainly shaped beauty. Smartphones, artificial intelligence, and the metaverse are changing how we present ourselves on and offline. But how has beauty shaped technology? Hi, I'm Isabella Rossellini. In the latest episode of This Is Not a Beauty podcast, we'll hear from a Meta executive, a Paralympian, and more. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform.
The quiet waters by.
Lately, I've been covering a lot of funerals. I find myself at the graveside, surrounded by family members. I put myself in their situation, and what would I do if I had lost my mother, or if I had lost my father or one of my siblings to this pandemic? Sadly, the feeling is quite familiar in a sense that I've spent so much of my career covering death and covering these really traumatic moments. My name is Lindsay Addario.
We've been reporting on the dire situation in Somalia, where a devastating famine has only been spreading.
And I have spent the better part of the last two decades covering conflict and humanitarian crises.
Now, we've got some truly important images to share with you, taken by award-winning photojournalist Lindsay Addario.
In most of my experiences covering Iraq and Afghanistan and Democratic Republic of Congo and Darfur, I'm photographing people who are trying not to die, who are trying to stay alive at all costs. Marike was the first person I had really met who wanted to die.
Hello, here you talking with Mrs. Marshmallow. No.
I had never met or photographed anyone who would constantly talk about how much she was looking forward to that moment where she could finally be at peace.
You know that I even don't know lots of pieces of the week. I don't know what happened.
And peace for her was death.
And the rest is counting down that I can die.
Whereas in the world that I had come from, peace for the people I photographed meant no war. It certainly did not mean death. It meant the antithesis of death.
A lot of people... It's very sad, but I'm very happy.
She wanted to show that death could be peaceful, that it was something that she was choosing.
So, just let me know what you think about it. Okay? Bye-bye.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is A Daily. 2 decades ago, Belgium passed the world's most liberal euthanasia laws, allowing thousands of patients who suffer severe medical conditions to end their lives. But nearly 20 years later, the process remains fraught for those trying to die, as well as their families. Today, photojournalist Lindsay Addario documented one woman's experience. It's Monday, January 24th.
In 2017, the New York Times sent me and writer Andrew Kay to profile Marike Vervoer. Marike had been very public about her desire to do euthanasia, and we thought it would be an interesting profile to go get a better sense of why, of what her daily life was like that was inspiring this real drive to end her life. But I didn't know much about Marike when I first got the assignment. All I knew was that she was a very accomplished Paralympic athlete from Belgium.
On your marks.
And when I started to do some research on her, I couldn't believe how much she had accomplished.
So away they go, Morgan in late.
She had won 4 Paralympic medals.
And out in 5, it's Verbord.
4 world records for track.
And it's Verbord of Belgium who gets away very, very quickly.
She was the world champion of the triathlon twice.
Gold in the 100, gold in the 200.
So a new Paralympic record, Marika Veervoort, 1969.
20.40 seconds for Marika Veervoort. So she takes the gold medal.
And competed in the Ironman in Hawaii in her wheelchair.
3 medals now, all gold for the Belgian. 100.
All of the finalists can be very pleased with what they did, but it's Veervoort of Belgium who's got the record and the gold.
She was just this incredible force of nature.
Veervoort has a degenerative spinal condition that leaves her in extreme pain and says she sometimes sleeps only 10 minutes a night and needs around-the-clock care. In fact, she was recently quoted as saying that after the Rio Games, she was considering euthanasia, which is legal in Belgium. Today, she clarified those reports.
In 2016, Marika held a press conference, and she announced that the Rio Games would be her last, and she was retiring from professional sports.
Yes, this is my last Paralympic Games. I have a progressive disease, and I signed my euthanasia papers already in 2008, because it's really, really hard to handle and to suffer with this disease. But the euthanasia, it gives me a feeling of rest. I live with a good feeling. Whatever happened, I have my papers in my hand, but I'm still enjoying every little moment. Well, when the moment comes that I have more bad days than good days, then I have my euthanasia papers.
I remember the first time I met Marika. I remember watching her being wheeled out by her nurse, Anne. She wore a Nike tracksuit, and she had this white blonde spiky hair that she used gel to spike straight up. She sort of gave this air of, like, no bullshit. She sort of greeted Andrew and I like, okay, you know, here you are. This is what we're going to do. And off we went. I think she just assumed it would be, you know, 1 or 2 trips to visit her and write a piece on her life. But it ended up being almost 3 years that we spent with her.
Hello.
Hello.
Okay. Let me put you.
My precious. Please don't look for us.
Okay. No, what I have to say?
I just want to talk about how you're feeling. Just because now we've known each other for 8 months.
Yeah, since that 8 months, a lot changed. 8 months ago, I had still good times, but now they're only bad times, and the control over my hands is going slowly more and more away. Not this night, but the night before, 3 times... I lost control over my hands, but then I cried really hard the whole night because what is going on here? I'm really scared. I'm so scared.
So what scares you? Are you afraid of dying? Are you afraid of the pain? Are you afraid of what makes you scared?
What's the next thing that's going to happen?
Marika often described her pain as a pain so much that her mind could handle it, but her body just couldn't. Suddenly, she would start shaking. Often it would start with her leg, and then it would sort of envelop her entire body. She would start coughing or choking, and suddenly she would have an all-body seizure. At this point, I had known Marieke almost a year. I had seen her through some pretty horrific nights. But I still was sort of reckoning with how difficult it is to decide when to die. I had never really seen someone make these decisions and really the things that went into consideration. Belgium is one of a handful of countries where euthanasia is legal for non-terminally ill patients. The requirements, though, are pretty rigorous. You know, for Marieke, in addition to the sort of bureaucracy and the logistics of getting the signatures, you know, there were really emotional decisions to make.
I have to choose a date and an hour and who had to stay with me when it has to happen. That's really, really, really difficult to say that.
And as long as I had known Marieke and as much pain as she was in, she still had not selected a date to die.
How will you know when the right time is? I mean, how does someone know when the time is
right? I feel now that my time is not coming.
Is there a limit to the people you can have in the room? Like, is there a number, a maximum number, or you decide how you want it?
I decide for myself. And but I decided already that I say first goodbye to my parents before I go to the room.
Marieke was pretty adamant that she did not want her parents in the room when she ended her life. I think in the beginning, her parents were not supportive of Marieke's decision to do euthanasia, and they finally came around. But I think that period where they just could not come on board really angered Marieke, and she felt like she wouldn't be able to go through with it if they were there watching her. I think it was sort of her way of protecting them by not letting them see her pass away. And it was causing a huge amount of stress, not only for Marieke, but for her parents. Marieke's mother and I ended up spending a fair amount of time together. We would go and have tea down in the cafeteria in the hospital when we were both sitting by her bedside. Or on occasion, Marieke's mother would invite me back to her apartment to have a glass of champagne. And one evening, I had gone to see Marieke and she was sleeping for hours. And her mother, Odette, said, come to my house. It was a few minutes walk from the hospital.
And it's because I feel good with you. I feel you are.
Yeah. And she took out a goodbye letter that she had written to Marieke.
My heart, my everything. I'm scared that you are
Going away.
In the mist. And never be with me.
Her English wasn't perfect at the time, but she really wanted to read it to me in English.
I showed you the bag open. And then I feel your hair. Mm.
What will you give her then?
I don't know.
Why don't you just tell her what you want to tell her?
A few weeks after reading me that letter, Odette collapsed in the bathroom and was rushed to the hospital, where she was put into an induced coma and ended up staying there for several months. It was unclear whether she would even survive.
My mother landed up in intensive care many times. The doctor said, prepare yourself. I think it's the last moment.
She had actually wanted to schedule her euthanasia after the end of February. And at that point, her mother was in a coma and no one really knew what would happen.
I had a discussion with my father as well. I told him, I don't know what to do anymore. My plan was to do the euthanasia after mom's birthday, but now she's in this condition. I can't do it. I can't do it. It would be very mean of me that she wake up and her daughter is away. My father told me, Marike, you don't have to wait on mom. It will be always very, very hard for everybody, especially for my mom.
And after, when her mom finally woke up and came to consciousness, Marike talked so fondly for the first time about how their family really became a family.
Before, we lived our own life. Now we lived more together. It was very special. So
does that give you hesitation to want to do it now? Because now your mom's awake and she might leave the hospital soon. So now do you feel like, okay, her birthday is past, she's awake, do you want to
wait?
Yeah,
but
now?
I don't... There is something that's holding me. I still hope that they found the therapy that's going better. So... I think there is a chance that I feel a little bit better, that I have more comfort. And the only thing that I want is comfort.
After Marike's mother came out of the coma, Marike sort of stopped talking about ending her life.
I hope for all the best for New Year. Big, big hug. Enjoy this evening. Bye-bye.
She just stopped talking about it until the following fall.
Hi, sunshine. I got terrible days. Today again, I got a lot of pain. It's getting too hard for me. It's difficult to say to you. I decided to do the euthanasia. I don't want to have my 40th birthday. So now you know the bad news. I hear you later. Bye-bye, sunshine.
We'll be right back.
How can a microchip manufacturer keep track of 250 million control points at once?
How can technology behind animated movies help enterprises reimagine their future?
Built for Change listeners know those answers and more. I'm Elise Hu.
And I'm Josh Klein. We're the hosts of Built for Change, a podcast from Accenture.
We talk to leaders of the world's biggest companies to hear how they've reinvented their business to create industry-shifting impact.
And how you can, too.
New episodes are coming soon, so check out Built for Change wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
story.
Ready. Ready.
So, last year when you were close to choosing a date before your mother's birthday, we talked about how you envision the end of your life, who would be in the room. Has that changed? Do you want your parents in the room now? How are you?
No,
what are you thinking?
No. It's too tough. It's too tough.
For them?
For them and for me as well.
Yeah.
Think they die a little bit with me.
So who are you thinking? Still the same?
Yes. It's a beautiful ending that that doesn't mean that it's something bad.
Mm-hmm.
It means it's for me a really good feeling, and I'm really thinking about it, and I hope that it's April that I can do it.
Marieke was really adamant that she wanted to end her life before her 40th birthday in early May. And she was desperate to get all the bureaucratic steps done. She needed 3 signatures from 3 different doctors, including her euthanasia doctor, Wim Diestelmans. She had to meet with 1 psychiatrist and also get a signature from that doctor. And for each of those appointments, she had to physically go to the hospital, which required having someone shuttle her back and forth on several occasions, something that wasn't necessarily easy for someone like Marieke, who didn't drive and who was in a wheelchair and who suffered from consistent seizures. And I think it became clear that she still had so much to do before she could confirm her death date.
My euthanasia, I'm so mad. Oh, it's impossible. If I have to make an appointment the 24th, I'm never got an appointment so fast. Oh, I'm sad. I cry a lot.
I got your message, and let's try and talk, because I know how sad you are. Is there any way that you might be able to do it, or you think it will be impossible because the timing is just too short? Anyway, sending love. Bye.
Hi, sweetheart. It's just getting really difficult. My doctor called, and I have to go to 2 different doctors who have to decide if my story is grounded or not, and also the psychiatrist, but he's also on holiday until after Easter. It's so tiring.
And eventually she just ran out of time. The doctor said that they were all going on vacation for Easter and that it would be impossible for her to make her early May date.
It's going so bad, and I don't have any freedom anymore. I'm getting 40 years old, and I'm living like old woman in my house.
The next date Marieke chose was at the end of September, but this date would end up getting pushed back as well. I was sort of on standby to go see Marieke in September and to be with her at the time of her death, and so we were in constant contact. At some point, Marieke sent me a message saying that she had been rushed to the hospital with sepsis. She had an infection, and she would need to stay in the hospital for 2 weeks at the end of September, which meant that her date would be pushed back. And I couldn't understand why, because, of course, I thought, well, If she's sick, couldn't they just end her life then? And that's just not the way it works. she had to be cured first and then could go home. Essentially, she was too sick to die. So in the time that I had known Marieke, she had selected 3 dates to end her life. The first date was pushed back because her mother ended up falling into a coma for several months. The second date was pushed back because of bureaucracy. She couldn't get the paperwork she needed. And the third date was pushed back because she ended up with an infection and was very sick. It was so ironic because the things that made living hard were also the things that made dying hard. Family, bureaucracy, and her own health. I decided I need to go see her in person. And I showed up, I sat down, I pulled up a chair, and I took out my notebook and I took out my phone. And I said, we need to talk about where you're at. Do you still want to end your life? Or is this, you know, now do you want to postpone as you've done in the past? And she was absolutely clear she was ready. And that's all she wanted. And that's when she picked up the phone and said, well, let's call Wim and see when he's available. And she called him, and the date was October 22nd. And so right then and there, she chose the date. So then we went through everything.
So I have, you will be in a red casket with white flowers. What type of flowers?
Tulips.
Tulips,
Okay. Or roses.
Or?
Tulips or roses.
Not both.
I think roses.
You mentioned before you wanted butterflies to come out.
Yes.
Okay, so explain again. I want to make sure.
If they go outside with the cask, there will be a little box with white butterflies. Will then, and they let them free as a sign that I finally released out of the body that's in pain and suffering. I'm so glad that you are here today.
Me too. I'm so happy about this.
Lindsay, you know, you are really somebody that's really in my heart.
Thank you.
About 30 minutes later, her parents walked in the hospital room. Her father, Jose, and her mother, Odette, took seats by her side. She immediately brought up, this is the new date, it will be October 22nd, and I really want Lindsay to be in the room, and I want her to take photographs of my death. And Marieke said, and I also want you in the room. And her mom started crying, and her father got a little choked up, like, finally, the invitation is there.
Do you stay in Belgium until the funeral?
So it depends on what happens. That's why I'm trying to figure out what the plan is. So I'll stay at your house. After the euthanasia, I will move to a hotel. So the evening...
You can stay in my house.
I know, but without you, once the euthanasia, I will feel funny. I mean, I don't know. Let's see how we feel.
I will feel funny.
I think it will be very difficult. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. Without you, with you there... Yeah.
It's weird with being with the dead one in the house.
I know. Just alone, me and you dead.
Yeah. And my ghost is going to... I'm going to get you.
Yeah, I can see you bothering me at night, you know?
Yeah, bothering you every time when you sleep, putting my hand on your shoulder. And you scared.
A week later, I had to fly to New York for my mother's 80th birthday. And at the same time, Andrew Kay, the writer on the story, decided to go visit Marieke one last time. And it was a Saturday night, and she was having a sort of going away party before her death. And I remember I was at a matinee with my mother. That's sort of all my mother wanted for her 80th birthday, was that her four daughters were with her. Right as we're walking in, I remember I got a message from Andrew that he was at the going away party and that it was really emotional. And he said, you know, I think it's really happening. And suddenly, in that moment, it hit me that she was actually going to die. I left New York on that Sunday to fly back to London and landed Monday morning, literally went home for an hour, changed the clothes in my suitcase, grabbed my cameras, got back to the train station, got on the Eurostar, went directly from the station to her. She was in the hospital at that point and just sat at her bedside for like as long as I could, and then asked her what time she wanted me to be there the next morning, which was the last day of her life. I woke up and I thought, this is the last day of her life, and I calculated the amount of hours she still had to live. The time that she was supposed to end her life was about 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock that evening. So I remember thinking, okay, she only has about 12 hours to live. And what does it feel like to live out your last 12 hours? When I got to the hospital, I thought she might be sort of somber. I had no idea what her temperament would be. And when I walked in, there were already two friends of hers drinking kava with her at her bedside. And so she was laughing and joking around with them. I mean, she was having the time of her life.
Oh, you can do it. Yes, you can. Believe you can.
I felt like sort of the heaviness was more on me than on her.
The most beautiful day in my life was the bungee jump and also winning the gold medal. Mm.
Of course.
Those two things.
Her mother, Odette, looked beautiful that day. She had her hair done and was wearing this very patterned, pretty sweater. And I just couldn't stop thinking, what must it feel like for Odette and Jose, you know, her parents? Like, how do you walk into this moment? How do you walk into a hospital room to pick up your child, to usher them to their death? We arrived back at the house, and Marieke kind of disappeared into the bathroom. And she was in the bathroom for a while. When she came out, her house was already full of people. It was about 20 people came over, and Marieke got onto the couch and fell asleep. She completely passed out for about 2 hours. People went and sat next to her, cried, talked to her, hugged her. She didn't move. I think she had medicated herself. Maybe at that point she realized emotionally this was going to be difficult. At that point, her father came to me and said, if the euthanasia doctors arrive at 7 o'clock and she cannot answer the question of whether she is ready to go through euthanasia, they will leave and it will not happen. At about 10 minutes before 7 o'clock, Marieke just sat straight up on the couch and said, I'm back. And she said, where's my kava? And she started drinking and eating chocolate and saying goodbye and laughing and having fun with her friends. And the doctors came in at 7 o'clock. And then Wim came over to her and basically said something like, okay, we're ready. And she had a half a glass of champagne and she chugged it and then asked for another and stuffed her mouth with Maltesers, which was her favorite chocolate. And then she offered chocolates to Wim and he sort of grimaced like, that's disgusting. I'm not going to eat Maltesers, you know. she asked for sort of a moment to finish eating and drinking. And then each one of the doctors took her by her hand and wheeled her down the hall. And they prepared her for her death. Then at that point, they called in her parents for a private goodbye. A few minutes later, Wim came out and said, "Okay, come in." We all filed into the room. I realized I had never said goodbye. And so I very quickly ran over and just kissed her on the forehead and said goodbye. And it was very, very quick. And they started with the injections and the catheter in her neck. I continued photographing until she was officially pronounced dead. And then we sort of all pulled away and gave the parents some time with her alone. We stepped out into the hall and we all thought that Marieke would want us all to open a bottle of kava for her. None of us could believe she did it. That was what everyone said, like, she really did it. She did it.
We'll be right back.
Hey, football fans. I'm Diana Rossini, senior NFL insider at The Athletic, part of the New York Times. I recently started the podcast Scoop City with my good friend Chase Daniel. He played backup quarterback for 7 different pro football franchises over 14 years. Our close access to football people helps us keep you in the know all season long. New episodes of Scoop City drop every Tuesday and Friday from The Athletic. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's what else you need to know today. The Times reports that new COVID infections have started to fall across the country, signaling that the Omicron wave of the pandemic has finally peaked. Through Friday, the U.S. was averaging 720,000 new cases a day, down from about 807,000 cases the previous week. Even so, deaths, which typically lag infections, continue to grow, surpassing 2,000 a day. Those, too, are expected to fall in the coming weeks. And over the weekend, British officials said that Russia was developing plans to install a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine, perhaps as a prelude to an invasion. Russia denied the claim, but U.S. intelligence officials said that the British information appeared to be accurate. Russia has already deployed more than 100,000 troops to Ukraine's borders that could, U.S. officials say, attack at any moment. Today's episode was produced by Sayre Quevedo. It was edited by Annie Brown, Wendy Doerr, and Michael Benoit, and engineered by Corey Schreppel and Marion Lozano. Our theme music is by Jim Runberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Special thanks to Andrew Kay, Becky Leibowitz, Randall Archibald, and Andrew Doss. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.